to Refreshing Reflections. I'm Sean Scott, and today I'm reading the October 2019 issue of The Guidepost. I begin with the editor's note, Edward Grenenen, editor-in-chief. Miracle Fox. Lately, I've become a bit obsessed by accounts of a little blue Arctic fox who traveled a mind-blowing 2,175 miles across open sea ice in just 76 days in her quest for a new home to start a family. Researchers in Norway had attached a pink satellite transmitter to the young female to study her local migration patterns. Boy, were they in for a surprise. They theorized that changes in climate forced the vixen to seek an improved habitat for mating and feeding her young. So off she went, all the way to Canada, where the transmitter finally petered out. In one day alone, she covered an astonishing 96 miles. Scientists at first thought the intrepid fox had been picked up by a boat, but soon realized there was no ship traffic that far north in the frozen Arctic Ocean. One scientist called the epic journey a miracle of nature. What I found miraculous was that God could instill in this wonderful little creature such courage, stamina, and determination in order for her to undertake a perilous trek for the sake of her future offspring. In this issue, you will read stories from people similarly blessed with bravery and commitment. Melissa Dale, for instance, came close to taking her life rather than deal with the devastating effects of her gambling and drug addictions. Today, she is sober and leads a recovery program for other addicts. Korea McIntyre believed her comatose husband could hear her and eventually recover. Even though doctors were skeptical, Elizabeth Sherrill tells how famed Spanish architect Antonio Gaudí forfeited his health and his wealth to see his beloved Barcelona Cathedral rise into the sky. And then, there's this month's cover story by award-winning actress and singer Cynthia Erivo, a story you are going to love as much as I do. Cynthia plays abolitionist Harriet Tubman in the upcoming biopic, Harriet. The actress tells how Harriet Tubman's faith was her entry point into playing the historical figure who risked so much for a freer world. Go buy a movie ticket. Meanwhile, I'm going to tell my friends at All Creatures Magazine about the little fox who could. Someone cares. Pass it on. Right on, matey. By Allison Churchill, editorial assistant. Since getting out of the Army, I've gotten involved with a number of veterans groups. I've avoided the ones that organize outdoor activities, though, because I did enough of those while serving. Which made me glad that the local chapter of the Travis Mannion Foundation, a veterans group that focuses on character building, teamed up with Story Pirates, an education nonprofit for story love. Story Pirates cast members visit schools to help kids write stories and then act out a few of those stories. To make sure no one feels left out, even if their story isn't performed, volunteers write an encouraging note to every participant through the Story Love program. That's right, up my alley. The Travis Mannion Foundation Story Love Nights are a blast. The Story Pirates have a letter template so we can focus on reading about fascinating creatures and their excellent adventures, such as dogs playing basketball, dinosaurs taking time machines to outer space, foods, finding secret portals in the supermarket, and commending the authors for their vivid imagination. I caught the writing bug early and kept at it, thanks to the support of adults in my life. Maybe one of these young writers will someday appear and guideposts. Free smiles. I work in a hospital. At my orientation, all the new employees watched an empathy film so we'd be aware of what patients and their families might go through. Worries over paying for treatment, saying goodbye to a loved one for the last time. A little kindness can make all the difference to a person. Since then, I make sure to smile at and say hello to everyone. At first, it was just people at the hospital. Patients, co-workers, visitors to brighten potentially bad days. It felt great when people smiled back, but I never took it personally if they didn't. Now, I smile at people everywhere I go, at cashiers and fellow shoppers at the grocery store, at the movie theater. I hope that seeing for a moment that someone cares helps strangers deal with the difficult situations in their life. Best of all, smiling is free. Why don't you give it a try? Lori Ratzap, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Pillows for patients. My church, Holy Trinity Lutheran, has a rather large congregation. In 2002, the parish health minister suggested forming a pink ribbon group because at least 20 of us, including me, had breast cancer. I've since completely recovered. We met monthly for inspiration, information, and support. At one meeting, we decided to make neck pillows for other cancer patients as a service project. A neck pillow makes it easier to rest during a chemo session. We picked fleece for the covers so they would be washable. One of our members created a card with our information to attach to the pillows. Another had an embroidery machine and designed an emblem for the pillows. Fellow congregants donated so much fleece that our Pink Ribbon Support Club enlisted volunteers to help sew, stuff, and deliver the pillows to local chemotherapy wards. At my sister's suggestion, we started praying over each pillow. We've made and prayed over more than 5,000 pillows, and we'll keep going as long as they're needed. Hopefully, they're as big a blessing for the recipients as this group has been for me. Phyllis Muhlenthaler, Ankeny, Iowa. Locked In by Carla McIntyre of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hundreds of swimming caps bobbed in the blue-green water of Northwest Indiana's Wolf Lake. I strained to catch a glimpse of my husband, Todd, among the Leon's triathlon competitors. "Do you think he's okay?" I asked Emily, my teenage daughter. We come from our home in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The first racers were already making their way across the beach to their bikes for the second leg. "He's been out there a long time." Emily nodded, her lips pressed tight. This wasn't easy for either of us. I'd never worried about Todd the first 7 years of our marriage, the second for both of us. He was strong, tall, independent, retired Navy, though he still worked the same job as a nuclear health physicist. He absolutely lived to compete. He'd done 75 triathlons and 35 marathons, a passion that bordered an obsession. Vacations were spent traveling to competitions. His training regimen, times, distances, split routes, heart rate, and more. All recorded faithfully on a spreadsheet, took priority over everything, including me, I sometimes felt. I resented the time it took away from us, from family, from church. I'd never understood it. Until our world turned upside down in 2015. Nearly 2 years later, all that mattered to me was helping him reclaim that drive again, to be the old competitive Todd. The thing that had bugged me most about him. Now, I give anything to get it back. June 2015. We just come back from dinner, our third night in Aruba, an early anniversary celebration. It was the first time in more than a year we'd gone someplace, just the two of us. I'd planned every part of the trip. I was working for a corporate travel management company at the time, a dream job for someone who thrives on attention to detail and no surprises. "I think I'm having a heart attack," Todd said. "My chest is really hurting." "It's probably just something you ate," I said. My 50-year-old husband was not having a heart attack. I mean, he just completed the Boston Marathon that past April and qualified for the following years. "We should go to the hospital," Todd insisted. A taxi took us to a small hospital where an EKG confirmed Todd's fears. The doctor couldn't do a heart catheterization, the treatment that would have been done in the U.S. "We'll give him a mix of blood thinners," a doctor explained. "That should stabilize him enough to get home." I wasn't allowed to stay overnight in the cramped hospital. I found myself praying Todd would be in good hands. Besides saying grace and attending weekly mass, I never prayed much. In fact, it scared me. I was worried enough to pray for my husband. Todd had always seemed invincible. The next morning, I spoke to the hospital and Todd was doing great. Then, in the time it took for a routine brain scan, everything changed. He was bleeding. A cerebellum hemorrhage, the doctor said. He needed emergency surgery. A priest on call performed last rites. "I don't know if we can save him," the doctor said. A shunt was implanted, but Todd's condition dramatically worsened. He slipped into a coma. I was in shock. If I can just get him back to the U.S., there had to be something doctors with more expertise could do. I arranged an air ambulance to a trauma center in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, despite the warning that Todd wouldn't survive the flight. I called my family back home to inform Emily and Todd's adult sons, Greg and Colby. A friend started a prayer chain. Another friend from Todd's work flew down to be with me. I was beyond exhausted. On board the flight, sitting next to Todd, I couldn't hold my eyes open. I turned my head. A man sat just feet away, adorned in a radiant white robe. "Todd will recover," he said, his voice soothing, yet powerful, commanding, yet comforting. "But the days ahead won't be easy. Remember, I am with you." What? Only God himself could give me that kind of assurance. Could this really be him? Was this Jesus? I had so many questions. The vision faded. There was only Todd beside me. The plane quiet except for the sound of the engine and the ventilator keeping my husband alive. I squeezed Todd's hand. The plane landed, and an ambulance whisked us to the trauma center. More surgery, this time for herniated brain stem. But the doctors were no more hopeful. "He'll likely never regain any significant brain function," they said. Medically, I had nothing to cling to. Just the inexplicable vision, or was it a dream, on the plane? And a thought that wouldn't leave me. "You don't know, Todd." That almost incomprehensible drive. I couldn't give up on him. I called 10 neurosurgeons back in Pittsburgh before I found one willing to admit him to an ICU. For 46 days, doctor drained fluid from his brain and administered meds to fight infection. I never left Todd's side. I massaged his arms and legs, played soothing music and DVDs of elite athlete triathlons, the ones he used to watch while riding his stationary bike. At last, he was stable enough to be transferred to an acute long-term care center. His eyes were open, but he remained unresponsive, breathing through a tube in his trachea. It was mostly a kind of holding pattern. Todd would have never wanted to be kept alive like this. I was sleeping at home now. How could I hold out? I didn't have Todd's strength. On August 4th, I woke up angry. It was our 8th anniversary, nearly 2 months since Aruba. I was done. Lord, if Todd is still here, in there, he needs to show me something. An idea came to me on the way to the care center. I want you to plug his trach, I told the speech therapist. If he can talk, that means there's brain activity. If he can't, I couldn't bear to say the words. Reluctantly, she blocked the hole in Todd's throat, then stood back. Todd lay in his bed. I pressed my lips against his ear. You need to step up. Say something. No one believes in you but me. Help me prove them wrong. No response. Not even an eye blink. I turned away. I love you. Apiversary. The words garbled, barely above a whisper. But there was no mistaking that voice. Todd still fighting. Oh, honey, I said. I turned, but his face showed no hint of what we just witnessed. The speech therapist and I exchanged glances. We need to reassess, she said. The new diagnosis was nearly as grim. It's called locked-in syndrome, the doctor explained. It's a neurological condition in which the patient is aware but cannot move, and in most cases, can't communicate verbally due to paralysis of nearly all voluntary muscles. There's rarely improvement. I'm sorry. Still, I insisted Todd be transferred to a rehab hospital. He was weaned off his trachea tube and received daily therapies. He grew more aware, making sounds. The doctors warned me not to expect much, but I clung to that vision on that plane. The last day of September, Todd's Reiki therapist was working on his scalp. The energy I'm feeling, it's burning hot, she said. The doctors agreed to an MRI. It showed a brain infection near the shunt. A surgeon removed the shunt. Something happened during operation, as if a key were turned that had unlocked him. Almost overnight, Todd became alert, his speech more clear, able to move his fingers, turn his head. I can't explain it, the doctor said. This just doesn't happen. You remembered to register me for Boston, right? The deadline was in September. Todd said one day, his words were garbled, but understandable. How was I supposed to tell him? There was no way he was running a marathon. He couldn't even stand on his own. Of course, I hadn't sent in the registration. That was the last thing on my mind. Yes, I did, I said. I felt awful about lying, but there was no way I was going to crush his spirit. October 22nd was Emily's birthday. On his own, Todd called her and very shakily sang, Happy birthday. Nearly every day, Todd was making advances. Everyone marveled at his drive, his intensity, that all too familiar obsession with reaching the next level, one I had always struggled to understand. Just before Christmas, Todd came home, getting around in a wheelchair. By the following April, he went back to work part-time. Labor Day weekend, we had a huge party. There wasn't a dry eye in the house when Todd thanked everyone for their support and their prayers. I especially want to thank my wife, he said, his words coming out slowly, deliberately. Without her, I literally wouldn't be here. Our relationship had changed forever. For the first time in our marriage, it felt as if we were truly connected. We prayed together, feeling God's presence in our lives in a way we never had before, in a way that started on the plane. Jesus had been with us on this whole journey. By the spring of 2017, Todd had achieved the impossible, but I couldn't tell he was struggling, unhappy with the challenge of walking more confidently with a cane. He needed a bigger test. I looked for races for people with disabilities. I found Leon's triathlon, a sprint triathlon with a primary focus on disabled veterans. When I called, I learned that Todd, a 27-year Navy veteran, could definitely have a slot. I want to do it, Todd said, that familiar gleam in his eye. He made a harness so he could walk on the treadmill, used a hand cycle to train for the bike leg, started swimming, recording his times every day in his resurrected spreadsheet. Now, standing on the shore of Wolf Lake with Emily, I couldn't help but second-guess myself. Racer after racer, a lot of them amputees, streamed past. There was no sign of Todd. Like many of the racers, he was swimming with an aide. Finally, he emerged from the lake and, with the help of the aide, made his way to the hand cycle. Minutes later, he was out of sight, chasing the pack. That competitive obsession was no longer a mystery to me or a bane to our marriage. God had blessed Todd with it, knowing fully the challenges that lay ahead of him. And it was a gift to me, too, as much as that moment on the plane when I was given hope for the impossible. Mysterious Ways by Amy Maturo of the Woodlands, Texas. My grandma had been my world when I was growing up. She practically raised me. I can still recall sun-tinted afternoons spent watching her nimble fingers sew and hem clothes, surrounded by the scent of her signature lilac perfume, and by her love. "I'll always be with you," she told me before she died, her hands clasped in mine. "If you ever need me, just call out." Now I was a mom, and I needed her more than ever. My one-year-old son, Adam, was sick, and no one at the hospital could tell us what was wrong. It had started small, an upset tummy. I wasn't too worried. Babies' immune systems aren't fully developed, but it only got worse. Adam grew listless. By the time we took him to the hospital, he couldn't keep anything down. The doctors did dozens of tests and still didn't know what was causing it. After 2 days, Adam was moved to the isolation ward in case what he had was communicable. He looked so tiny and frail in the hospital bed. The only hope we had were our constant prayers for God to save our son. Tonight was my husband's turn to stay with Adam. I lingered in the hallway, watching our little boy through the observation window before finally heading home. Physically and emotionally spent, I couldn't even make it upstairs. I crumpled in the living room, falling to my knees. "Grandma," I cried. "Grandma, please help me. I need you." When my sobs subsided, I crawled to the couch and fell into an exhausted sleep. Lilacs. All I could smell were lilacs. Whether it was a dream or a vision, I don't know. But I was back at the hospital. I stood in the hallway watching Adam through the window of the isolation ward, my heart aching. Suddenly, there was someone standing beside me. "Grandma." She turned and looked into my eyes. "He'll be all right now," she said before walking away. "Grandma," I called out after her, but she kept walking. Then she was gone. Ring, ring. The living room phone jarred me awake. It was my husband. Amy, he said. The doctors say that Adam has stabilized. He's going to be okay. I clutched the phone, tears welling in my eyes, and the unmistakable scent of lilac perfume hanging in the air. Well, we are out of time, but I would like to leave you with a quote by Ellen McDowell, artist. Finding yourself is not how it works. You aren't a $10 bill in last winter's coat pocket. Finding yourself is actually returning to yourself, remembering who you were before the world got its hands on you. Thank you for listening. I'm Sean Scott, and until next time, may we all be refreshed.